Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh, and at 1400 GMT on Wednesday the 22nd of May, these are our main stories. Norway, Ireland and Spain are to recognise Palestine as an independent state in a move condemned by Israel as a reward for terrorism. Russia says it's captured another village during heavy fighting in the Donetsk region of Ukraine. Kyiv says the situation there is very difficult. A huge crowd has been following the funeral procession of the late Iranian president Ibrahim Raisi through the streets of Tehran. Also in this podcast...
Cease fire, please!
I do not wish to fight against you, because I think of you as my brothers.
In Myanmar, opposition fighters express confidence as they urge soldiers to surrender. As the trauma in Gaza continues, a new stage in the international political backlash against Israel.
Last month I stood on these same steps with Prime Minister Sanchez of Spain, and we said that the point of recognising the state of Palestine was coming closer. That point has now arrived. Today, Ireland, Norway and Spain are announcing that we recognise the state of Palestine.
That was the Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris speaking in Dublin earlier today. It followed similar announcements by his Norwegian counterpart, Jonas Gahr Støre, and by the Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez.
We're going to recognise Palestine for many reasons, and we can sum that up in three words: peace, justice and consistency. We have to make sure that the two-state solution is respected, and there must be mutual guarantees of security. This has been required by many other states as well as us.
Hamas hailed the move as a turning point, but the Israelis are furious and have recalled their envoys from all three countries. So lots of strands to pull together. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale told me a bit more about what the trio of announcements may mean.
This is something they've been talking about for some time. They've been trying to coordinate so that it makes a political impact. The last European country to recognise the state of Palestine was Sweden in 2014, and that slightly sort of disappeared. It didn't really have that much impact. So they wanted to act together. It's possible other countries will join them in coming days. And essentially their aim is to shift the diplomatic dial, essentially to sort of get people talking once again about the idea of a two-state solution. And clearly, by definition, a two-state solution requires a Palestinian state. At the moment, most countries that oppose a Palestinian state or won't recognise one now say, look, we do want one, but only in the long term, as part of a long-term political settlement. What these three countries are saying is, look, we're going to join the mainstream, because most countries in the world do recognise Palestine. And they're trying to say, look, if you're going to get any progress in the Middle East, you've got to have some kind of political process. Let's get back to that.
Well, how big a blow is this to Israel, especially given the announcement early this week that the International Criminal Court was seeking arrest warrants against Mr. Netanyahu and his defence minister?
Look, in practical terms, it's not going to make any difference at all. Palestinian state is not going to come into existence just because three more countries say we recognise it. Nine countries in Europe do that already, most of them former Soviet countries. But what I think it does do is it adds political and diplomatic pressure on Israel, as you say, coming in the wake of the ICC prosecutor's announcement. But in practical terms, I don't think Israel will worry too much about this. There's a lot of fury and rhetoric going on. Israel's foreign minister has denounced this, saying that the move undermines Israel's security and its sovereignty. And he's recalled his country's three ambassadors from Norway, Spain and Ireland. But I think that the Israelis will have long expected this. As ever, the bottom line for them is what does the United States, their main ally, think, and their main military supporter. And at the moment, the United States clearly takes the view not to recognise a Palestinian state until it is part of a final long-term political settlement to the whole region.
James Landale. This was the scene in Tehran earlier today. Tens of thousands of Iranians, mostly men, lined the streets of the Iranian capital for the main funeral ceremony of late President Ebrahim Raisi. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, led prayers for the president, who was killed along with the foreign minister in a helicopter crash on Sunday. From Tehran, Mr. Raisi's body will be taken to Mashhad, his home city in the northeast, to be buried on Thursday. State media say high-ranking foreign dignitaries will attend. What does all this mean for the future of Iran? Here's our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette.
These kind of scenes today, the throngs of people surging through the streets, men in turbans, women in long black shawls, shouting today again, death to America, death to Israel, has become the signature of the Islamic Republic of Iran. People have come out in the streets like that ever since Iran's revolutionary leader came in 1979 for the revolution. But of course, decades on, it's a very different Iran, and there have been not just these kinds of scenes of mourning, and some of the mourning is genuine. Some of it is people have been bussed in. There have also been scenes of celebration when the news broke early Monday morning that the president, Ebrahim Raisi, his foreign minister, Abdullah Yan, and six others had perished in a helicopter crash in the northwest of Iran, which is why there have been warnings by the top prosecutor and action. Police cases have already been filed against Iranian websites who have, in their words, been publishing lies and insults, criticizing the deceased president.
Well, indeed, he was a very divisive figure.
He was a very divisive figure. He came of age during the revolution. He was a protege of the first revolutionary leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, and then grew very close and was seen to be absolutely loyal to the current supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. And he has been in recent weeks, he's been cited as one of the leading contenders to take on the top job. But for many Iranians, he is also associated with the darkest chapter, one of the darkest chapters in this history. He was on what was called a death committee as a young prosecutor when thousands of political prisoners were executed. He always said that he didn't sign the death warrant, but he was certainly part of that process. And those who have celebrated his death have said that what they really wanted was an investigation into what really happened. And of course, in recent years, on his watch, Iran saw unprecedented protests against clerical rule, and in particular, the restrictions imposed on a new generation, most of all, women. He, of course, would have been part of that crackdown, which Human Rights Group says killed at least 300 people and thousands were detained.
Lise Doucette. The village of Klishivka in Ukraine is one of only a handful on the Eastern Front that Kyiv claimed back in its counteroffensive last year. But now Russia says its forces have taken the village again. The Ukrainian army has come under intense pressure in the past 2 weeks, fighting off a fresh Russian offensive in the northeastern Kharkiv region, while also facing shortages of ammunition across the front lines. So has this village been retaken by the Russians? Our correspondent in Kyiv is James Waterhouse.
It's disputed by the Ukrainian military, for a start. I mean, we've got this one-line statement from Russian forces saying its units had liberated the village of Klishivka in the Donetsk region. But the wording they use is in the Donetsk People's Republic. That is a label for territory which Russia occupied as far back as 2014. So it's clear in the medium term that Russia is trying to occupy the entire Donetsk region as well as the Luhansk region further north. I think that's a definite, more immediate goal. But in its dispute, really, in its denial that this has happened, the Ukrainian army says it's repelled around six major attacks around this area from the direction of Bakhmut, which was captured early last year. The spokesman says three were repelled. And we're talking about attacks where you see sort of groups of armoured vehicles and tanks storming through, and troops then disembark and try and capture Ukrainian positions. And at the moment, we're told that the situation is under control, but there is still heavy fighting. And the adjective President Zelensky goes for is extremely difficult to characterise the whole eastern and northeastern front. The reason things are so difficult, notably in the Donetsk region, is because Ukrainian forces have had to redeploy further north because of this new Russian incursion across the border into the Kharkiv region.
Yes, so despite the words from Ukraine, how significant is this Russian encroachment?
Well, in the village of Klishivka, I think we're still talking about, you know, it's not significant on its own. I think if you're talking about the direction of the Russian forces trying to take a town called Chazivyar, which is on a hill, which is well connected, that would put Ukraine in a very difficult position because it sees that event in the line of sight for invading forces like Kostantinivka, like Kramatorsk, like Kupiansk further north, where invading forces are getting closer. And so what, in a very deliberate way, I think, is Russia trying to draw Ukrainian forces further north.
James Waterhouse. It's an odd look when a political party bars its lead candidate from appearing at election events. But that's just what the far-right Alternative for Germany has done with its lead candidate for the forthcoming European elections, Maximilian Krah. It follows a series of statements, including the latest in which he said Nazi SS officers weren't necessarily criminals. Damien McGuinness reports from Berlin.
Maximilian Krah was supposed to lead Germany's far-right AfD in the European Parliament elections. Instead, he is now stepping down from the party's leadership and will not appear at any campaign events. Mr. Krah was already accused of links to China and alleged payments from Russia. But the final straw came when he told an Italian newspaper that Nazi soldiers and Hitler's SS weren't necessarily criminals. This sparked outrage among far-right allies in France and Italy, where the SS committed atrocities in the war.
Damien McGuinness. For the first time, breakdancing, officially known as breaking, will be part of the Olympic Games. Manisha Talash is the only female breaker representing Afghanistan. She fled when the Taliban returned to power in August 2021 and has since been selected by the Olympic Committee as part of the refugee team. Karwoon Kamush has been to Spain, where Manisha has been training for the Paris Olympics in July.
By going to the Olympics, I want to show that Afghan girls will never surrender. They will win despite any challenge or obstacle.
Manisha Talash started breakdancing at a hip-hop club in Kabul 4 years ago. She was the only girl in her class. She knew she would need to be confident to make steps towards her Olympic dream.
Today we had a car explosion near to our club.
But things haven't been easy. In a conservative society, hip-hop fans have many enemies. Many faced attacks. Manisha continued despite the threats and the bombing attempt on her club. They had to close their venue and she continued her training at home. But when the Taliban returned to power, they banned women's sport. Manisha and her friends were forced to leave the country.
This is my bedroom. I moved here a month ago, but I would like to be surrounded by the things I like.
I am meeting her in her small flat in Madrid. Her bedroom is full of posters of artists like Tupac, Biggie, Rihanna and Nicki Minaj. But above a picture of racing cars, I see poster of a bomb blast.
Some posters that remind me of Afghanistan, like bombs and the Afghan dancing girl. I'd like to remember what I have been through.
Dear refugee athletes,
after she became a refugee, Manisha thought she would never get into the Olympics. But earlier this month, the Olympic Committee announced that there would be a refugee team. She watched the announcement from her sofa. Thomas Bach, president of Olympic Committee.
Here are the athletes of the IOC Refugee Olympic Team Paris 2024. Manisha Talash, breaking.
Manisha will be part of the Olympic refugee team and will represent all those who have been forced to flee their home country globally. The announcement is a source of immense pride for her coach. Jawad Sabri, a member of the Superiors crew and AK-13 band, was her first coach who came to Madrid with her.
In 2021, you say we will go to the Olympics, and in 2024, you are in the Olympics. Imagine, and you did it.
Breaking was categorized as an Olympic sport in recent years and added to the Paris 2024 Olympic Games. It will be a tough competition, but Manisha's selection is a proud moment for the hip-hop community of Afghanistan. For them and for many women in the country, it is already a big win.
Kawun Kamush. Why mango picking season in Uganda has become a hazard.
Sometimes they find you in a garden, you'll get attacked by the elephants. But the government is not paying attention to our cry for help.
Three years after the civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi was overthrown, the coup leaders in Myanmar have lost control of more than half the country. After peaceful opposition was put down in 2021, the opposition began an armed resistance, while ethnic rebels stepped up their long-running insurgencies. Last October, some of those groups joined forces and began making huge territorial gains, posing the biggest challenge to the military government in years. Our correspondent Quentin Somerville travelled with rebel forces to their jungle bases and on front lines where the insurgents are challenging Myanmar's generals like never before.
Well, now, as you can hear, are cicadas in the trees. We're walking through a park in Loikot, the state capital, and heading towards the front line with some fighters from the KNDF, one of the Karemi rebel groups. In November, they launched a surprise attack on this city, pushing the military back. They control about half this city, but overall, in Karemi State, they say they've taken 90% of the state. Mortar craters, airstrikes, destruction all around here. This was the government area, hit by mortars, etc. Something really significant has been achieved because they were in the jungle. That's where their resistance was, but now they're here in the city, right in the heart of state power. And the people who were oppressing them are cowering now in buildings, in basements, while these rebel forces have them at least on the ground, surrounded. The military have held power here for more than half a century. They have warplanes, tanks and artillery. The opposition forces barely have body armour and are running short of ammunition. It's difficult terrain. The main roads are still within range of army guns. In my month with the insurgents, we barely ever took main roads, just steep jungle tracks and dirt trails. They took us near the town of Sisang in Shan State. Philip from the KNDF was our guide.
You can see the far away, the village. The yeah. Military said they're arriving there because our people in there very far.
The artillery shell landed about 200 metres from where we are. It's all open farmland here, but the military forces have actually infiltrated around this area through the villages. So it seems like the front line's a bit more fluid.
Let's get into these trenches here.
So that's, I think, three shells have come in the last 5 minutes. And you really get the sense of what this conflict is about, because that is a professional military over there, firing artillery, firing mortars. These men are irregulars. They're a strong alliance and they've had a lot of success, but they're taking on a professional army.
It's very close now. So now it's not safe. So better we go back.
Let's go, but fast.
Let's go.
Let's get out of range.
Ready? Yo, Damia! Kakwayeta!
Under the shade of some mango trees at one of his hidden encampments, I meet Maui Po Taiki, the powerfully built, tattooed commander of the KNDF, the Karenni Nationalities Defence Force. an environmentalist who studied in the United States. He first picked up a gun 3 years ago and hates military titles. "Please don't call me general," he says.
"More than 350 our brother and sister already sacrificed their life. More than 200 sacrificed for their body parts. At the same time, hundreds of people are willing to join with us and willing to fight against the Burma army. So those are our strengths. We do have enough heart. We do have enough moral. We do have enough humanity. That's the way how we're going to defeat them."
Hundreds of the fresh recruits who graduate today are marching in their rubber-soled canvas shoes and their full uniforms. This rebel group has seen its ranks swollen by the fact that the military junta that runs this country have enforced conscription, and that's forced a lot of young men and women into rebel areas. This is the biggest graduation they've ever seen here. As the ceremony ends, the mood is wild. A young rapper, MC KR Lay, who also graduated that day, sent the fresh recruits into a frenzy of dancing and celebration. Their ranks have never been stronger, their battlefield victories never greater, but their enemy has more firepower and more manpower. These men and women graduating today say that won't stop them. Their victory may not come tomorrow or even soon, but the momentum in this war to free Myanmar is on their side.
Quentin Somerville. Min Zhao U is the executive director of Myanmar's Institute for Peace and Security and was a rebel guerrilla himself many years ago before becoming a peace negotiator. Is it surprising that so many civilians were now taking up arms in the fight against the military government?
After the military coup, we recorded over 400 newly formed armed groups popped out. Yeah, that was a quite significant phenomena that was unprecedented in Myanmar history. Generally, what we could say is ethnicity-driven armed groups fight better than ideologically-driven armed groups in Myanmar. So this is a pattern.
The presence of so many different armed groups and perhaps the superiority in fighting that you described there of the ethnic armed groups, it's perhaps not very promising for the country's future as a stable country that exists where all the different ethnic groups can coexist.
The future is bleak for many different reasons. Even if the military is defeated, a lot of these armed groups and the different commands, we don't know how they're going to proceed without having any concrete solution. And now we have already observed intergroup fightings in different parts of the country where the military were pushed out. So that means that one, the military was a very significant common enemy. So all these groups are fighting against the military. But when the military was pushed out, then these groups, they're competing for like territorial control and also economic resources. A lot of armed groups operate in many different areas, taxing on businesses, logging, natural resource mining. Drug economy itself is like about 70 to 80 billions a year. So all these combined, even if the junta's gone, that kind of war economy persists. And a lot of civilians are now moving away from those conflict-affected areas, not only because of the fighting, but also because of those war economy and those taxation. So that became a very entrenched problem in Myanmar.
Min Zhao U was speaking to my colleague, James Copnell. It's been described as the biggest miscarriage of justice in the UK, and there were emotional scenes as the inquiry into the post office scandal resumed in London today, with, for the first time, the former post office boss, Paula Venables, giving evidence. She began by issuing an apology and then was asked about the aftermath of one of the sub-postmasters who'd taken their life after being wrongfully prosecuted on her watch.
I phoned the family and I spoke to the father, who explained to me that there were other issues involved. And I imagine that... I'm sorry. I imagine that I was probably...
Ms. Fennell, just rather than trying to talk through your...
I beg your pardon.
Just pause.
Yes, OK.
Try and compose yourself if you can, and then continue your evidence, please.
Thank you.
Hundreds of sub-postmasters, the people that run small post offices, were prosecuted for stealing after faulty software wrongly said money was missing from branch accounts. Many went to prison for false accounting and theft. Others were financially ruined. Some, as we've heard, took their own lives. Our UK correspondent Rob Watson has been following events at the inquiry and told me more about its significance.
It looks like being the biggest miscarriage of British justice in living memory, maybe beyond that. It's nearly 1,000 postmasters were affected. And the reason why I think it hits home so much in the UK is because the post offices are at the heart of many communities. So people go in there to collect their pensions. People go in there to do all sorts of business. So these people were known in the community. And then a TV drama really brought this home, this idea of ordinary people having been persecuted, had gone to prison, as you said, some ended up committing suicide. Now, Paula Venables, she was the head of the whole thing, and up until very, very recently, she had insisted the post office had done nothing wrong, there had been no miscarriages of justices, and the prosecutions continued. And so far, her answer has been, look, I was just too trusting. I believed too many reassurances that the software was okay. I just didn't see what was happening. It wasn't reported back up to me. Now, whether that is seen as credible, and really interestingly, there was a dramatic moment in the inquiry when she was confronted with a WhatsApp message from one of her own friends, a senior management, a colleague, who'd said, how could you not have known? I mean, all these years, how could you not have known?
Now, some of the victims of the scandal actually turned up outside the hearing today. What do you think they'll have been making of what they've heard so far?
I suspect that they will think it's just incredible that someone could have been running the post office, could have been in such a senior position and could have carried on telling the world that there was nothing wrong with the software and that there had been no miscarriages of justice. I mean, I suppose they will be struck by the way in which she at one point was in tears and has repeatedly said that she apologises, that she's very sorry for what happened. But again, I suspect based on what they will have heard so far, they will be asking the same question that senior executive posed to her in a WhatsApp message, which is, how could you not have known that things were going wrong?
And just briefly, put this into a context for a global audience, Rob. How big a scandal is this for the UK?
It's a huge scandal for the reason I said that these post offices are at the heart of community life. But I think because it feeds into that sort of wider sense of malaise in Britain, that the system doesn't seem to be working, nothing seems to be working properly.
Rob Watson. It's mango season in Uganda, and with it comes a chance to enjoy the delicious fruit and make money from the harvest. But it's also a time of extreme danger. That's because hundreds of elephants from South Sudan cross the border and invade farmers' gardens to feast on the fruit. It's been happening for more than a decade, and many farmers now say they live in fear of the elephants, which encroach on their land while they're harvesting. One of those farmers is Scovin Iseta from Moyo District, one of the worst hit areas.
They come and destroy the properties, like the food crops. Sometimes they find you in a garden. You'll get attacked by the elephants. But the government is not paying attention to our cry for help. There is no action taken by the government. And the question is, how long the farmers like us suffer? The government has the mandate to see the citizens are protected in the hands of the elephant. Equal, the elephants are endangered animals that need to be protected. Much as we are aware that the elephant brings income to the government, it's the responsibility of the government to initiate projects that can prevent this elephant from coming to invade the farms of the people. Maize plantations, cassava plantation, even onion plantation. And when the elephant enters, they going to take the mangoes, but in the process of their movement, they will destroy all the crops. Whenever the season of mangoes comes around, definitely you'll find that at night hours, even daytime, the elephant enters in the garden. and destroy crops. So this caused a lot of fear in the minds of the people. The families suffered greatly in terms of hunger, and the government is not paying attention to us. For more than 15 years, the people of Dufele have been suffering in the hands of these elephants.
Farmer Scovin Isetta. In 1968, Louis Armstrong recorded what critics consider his last great musical performance at the BBC. Later this year, it will be released as an album with extra material along with the footage. The legendary trumpeter, then aged 67, was in London to promote What a Wonderful World, which had just topped the charts. Nicola Stanbridge has been listening to Lewis in London and delving into the BBC archives.
A return to glory for one of the greatest jazz musicians. Previously unreleased, longer versions and film footage of Louis Armstrong at the BBC, July the 2nd, 1968.
Hello, darling. This is Louis, darling.
Ricky Riccardi is head of the archive at the Louis Armstrong Museum in New York.
Well, to me, it really is Louis Armstrong's last hurrah. 2 months later, he was in intensive care, and then he was in and out of hospitals, trying so hard to get back on stage. Spirit was willing, but his body could no longer handle the toll. But that night, his chops, as he called them, were in top shape. And his tone, that swing feel that he just kind of put on the map, it's all there. And he just sounds really, really, really strong.
His health did suffer, didn't it, for his music and his playing style?
He normally was performing about 300 days a year. And so that first caught up with him in 1959. He had a heart attack, but it was a grueling life. His vocalist, Velma Middleton, died on the road in Africa, and his clarinetist Buster Bailey died on the road in 1967. His pianist Billy Kyle died on the road. By September 1968, he was having heart troubles, kidney troubles, which is why the 1968 BBC recording is so important.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Here comes 67-year-old Louis Armstrong now with the number one hit in London with What a Wonderful World. And that's actually what spurred on this 1968 tour of Great Britain. Could you imagine that life growing up in the battlefield of New Orleans, not knowing where his next meal comes from, sent to the Colored Waifs Home, which was basically a juvenile detention center, where he received formal lessons and learned how to play the cornet. And now he's almost 70 years old with another number one hit going around the world. It's just the ultimate rags-to-riches story you can ever dream of.
From the BBC Archives, an interview with Louis Armstrong, given during the 1968 UK tour.
It's so much in Wonderful World that brings me back to my neighborhood where I live in Corona, New York. And Lucille and I, ever since we married, we've been right there in that block. And everybody keeps their little homes up like we do. And it's just like one big family. I saw three generations come up in that block. And they're all with their children, grandchildren. They come back to see Uncle Satchmo and Aunt Lucille. So that's why I can say, I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That home is your museum, isn't it?
It is. The world's largest archives for any single jazz musician. Performance spaces were given trumpet lessons. Louis would have been very proud knowing that, you know, one day on this little block in Corona, which he thought about every time he sang What a Wonderful World, that there would be people coming from around that wonderful world to see his home and to see his museum.
Nicola Stanbridge. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter, and the producer was Ed Horton. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Bernadette Keogh. Until next time, goodbye.